Thank you. Please be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument in 071059, Financial Industries Corporation versus XL Specialty Insurance Company.
Court. Mr. Argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, in the previous argument in another case which presents much the same issue, there was a fair amount of speculation about what underwriters do or do not do and what insurance companies do or do not do. I think to properly analyze the two cases that are before you this morning, we really need to start at the most basic level, and that is the long-standing rule that an insurance policy is a contract and that the normal rules of contract interpretation apply to insurance policies. There are two of those rules of construction which I think are significant to us here today. The first, simply stated, is that forfeitures are disfavored. The second is that only a material breach of a contract provision excuses performance of that contract, and that the test for a material breach is that it prejudices the party whose contract has been breached. This rule was discussed most pertinently in this context, first in the Hernandez case in 1994, which, as your question in the earlier argument indicated, is the beginning or a point in the continuum that you were dealing with in the PAJ case only a brief time back. Hernandez dealt in the terms of a consent to settle issue, but it stated the rule generally that insurance contracts are treated as any other contracts for purposes of contract interpretation.
Is it your position then that after Hernandez and Page, there can be no such things as conditions precedent in contracts, insurance contracts? You have to judge them all by materiality?
I think there can be such thing. I mean, I think there can be things called conditions precedent, but I don't think the modern view is that that completely eliminates the requirement that there be materiality to a breach in order for it to excuse performance. But, and I think the reason for that is discussed in some detail in PAJ, which is you can simply take a contract and say everything in this contract is a condition precedent. And if you then apply to that the theory that, well, that means there's no materiality required, you get to horrible, draconian, unfair results.
But I guess that's my question is, would you then say that insurance companies can negotiate strict conditions precedent so long as it's over a material piece of the policy, a bargained for part of the policy?
I think, as Mr. Powers indicated in the earlier argument, you would need to put it in the insuring agreement in order to really do that.
What cases say that? Are there any? Is there any precedent?
I'm not sure there really is a case that says that, Your Honor. I think there aren't any cases that don't that say that isn't the case either. I think you will find a lot of cases which look to the insuring agreement to determine what the core risk transfer is that is being accomplished by the insurance policy.
But if we're going to say that they're saying a condition precedent doesn't mean what it says, what difference does it make if they put it in a different paragraph?
Well, I don't think really that's the way to look at it. I think if you look at the general rule of contract interpretation that a breach has to be material, that could be said the same way on anything. I mean, what you're always doing when you say a breach isn't material and therefore it doesn't excuse performance is you're saying, notwithstanding that the contract says this is a requirement and that it has been breached, we're not going to give that any effect because it didn't really harm the other party to the contract.
But what I'm saying, what difference does it make whether it's in the initial insuring agreement or in an exclusion or somewhere else if we're going to just ignore the policy language? What difference does it make where
it is? I think probably the best answer to that is that you're positing a difficult question which isn't before us today. If for instance, this was a true claims made and reported policy, in which
well,
I think it's a fair question.
I'm just addressing your statement that if we put it in the insuring agreement, that's better. And that's all I was addressing.
Right. Yeah, all I'm saying is it's better. I'm not saying it's necessarily the end of the discussion. But I think to try to move it out of the rules of normal contract interpretation, that gets you closer. But that's not the issue that's here today, and it's not an issue I think you need to decide to resolve these two cases.
I don't understand why you refer to normal contract construction principles, because if we had a contract that said if you produce a buyer by X day and time is of the essence, it's important to us, we'll pay you, and if you don't, you don't. We would look at that contract a lot differently if the producer was 2 days late or a day late than an insurance policy where they come in with a notice of delay. So do contract construction principles really apply to insurance policy? Mr. Power says in the first argument we should be honest and say they don't.
I think they do. I think that's the road that Hernandez started us down, that was the proper way to analyze it, and I think fairly viewed that's the decision, that's the path that you continued to follow in PAJ.
Well, but I guess my point is we used to think, all right, is this a condition preceding or not? And one of the issues would be, does it say so? Now we're saying, well, even if it says so, is it really? And then the next step is, even if it says so, can it be? And it seems to me that's a long way from general contract construction.
Well, I don't really think so, Your Honor. I mean, I think that what really has happened over probably the last 30 or 40 years is that the courts more and more have required materiality in a breach, however the contract is phrased. And I think the reason that is because the drafters of contracts have reacted every time it is moved by declaring more and more things to be more and more important things, and then that results in results that are so inequitable that courts feel that they have to step in and do something about it.
Well, but we were very careful in Page, I think, to say that we're basing it on a legislative policy choice for policies that the legislature regulates. And in the board order, the department spoke in terms of, we don't like this unless there's prejudice, this notice gotcha provision thing in occurrence-based policies. But in areas that the department doesn't regulate, why wouldn't we just apply general contract principles in those contexts? I mean,
well,
courts are reluctant to step into making policy choices like the department made in the board order.
I think to be honest, Your Honor, that although there is some discussion of the board order in PAJ, you can't use the board order as the basis for PAJ. The holding of PAJ is, quote, an insured's failure to timely notify its insurer of a claim or suit does not defeat coverage if the insurer was not prejudiced by the delay,
but
close quote.
We did not overrule Cataya. We said here was Cataya, and we enforced it as a condition precedent in the contract, and then we said, in Cataya, we said, legislature or department, step in if you want to. They did. Then Hernandez came and we said, okay, department said X. This is a policy choice that the department made, and therefore we're going to apply the materiality analysis here.
I don't think that's exactly right. Cataya is decided. The state board then enters two board orders which do not say we're declaring a public policy of X. They just say you are going to put a certain endorsement on two very particular kinds of policies that will say prejudice is required. You then go for a 10-year period in which the board does not extend that and does not decline to extend it. It doesn't express an opinion one way or the other, nor does the legislature work one way or the other. You then decide Hernandez, which is a consent to settle case, not a notice case, and you say, notwithstanding Cotea, we're going to require prejudice because that's the normal rule of contract interpretation, and this insurance policy is a contract. You then go for another many years without the board doing anything further or the legislature doing anything further to indicate that they disapproved of what the court had done in Hernandez, and you are presented with PAJ, which is a coverage that is clearly not covered by either of the board orders. And you decide that, notwithstanding the fact that there is not a board order which says there is a requirement of prejudice in this area, you are going to have a requirement of prejudice in this area.
What do you do?
What do you do with
the fact that we cited Matador and Page and said, unlike an occurrence policy, in a claims-made policy, the timely notice is an essential bargain for element, and that distinction means that you can have that sort of condition preceding. Didn't we say that in Page? And
well, what you did cite to Matador, and Matador, there are a couple of issues there. One is Matador, if you assume it is good law, relies upon three Texas cases which predated Hernandez. And all of those cases dealt with the issue in the context of a claims made and reported policy. And as we've pointed out at some length in our brief, one thing you have to be very careful with in this area is that many, many courts simply say claims made without making the distinction between claims made and claims made and reported. And you have to look at what the actual policy and fact situation is in the case to determine what they're talking about rather than just taking the quote out of context. So I think you can make a perfectly well-principled argument that Matador is referring to claims made in the sense of claims made and reported and has to be looking at the three Texas cases it relied on. You could make an argument that those cases were to some extent undercut by Hernandez, and the Matador court did not realize that. And that essentially is what the Fifth Circuit said when it certified this question in our case to you. Is one of the things we see is that our federal cases have been making a distinction between claims made and occurrence
After the certification, we cited Matador for the right. proposition that now you're saying has been undermined by Page.
Right. I think, again, that's really probably something you don't have to get to today is in a claims made and reported case, what do you do? I think what you have to get to today is that in a simple claims made policy in which there is no notice, no mention of notice whatsoever in the insuring agreement, is there any reason to treat it differently than the policy in PAJ? And the answer is no.
But we didn't get to this case in Pop.
I know, and that's why we're here arguing today.
So we should at least think about what's going to happen.
And what
is going to happen next in the claims and made and reported?
Well, I think you have to deal with that when you get to it. I mean,
that's what we said about this case,
right?
But that's
how the common law works, isn't it, Your Honor? Is that you take it one bite at a time and you don't try to figure out where you're going to go. The next case may have a showing of some sort of prejudice that helps you to say, well, we're going to require prejudice, but it's a pretty easy showing to make if the policy's drafted this way.
The issue, though, is are we going to require that showing in a claims made and reported policy?
Right. But I don't think that's something you can properly decide today. I mean, I suppose you could, but you're not required to decide it by either of the two cases that are before you today. both of which are simple claims made policies which require reporting as soon as practicable in a notice provision, not in the insuring agreement, and therefore are, I believe, indistinguishable from the PAJ policy, which was set up exactly the same way.
How many of the important or material provisions of an insurance policy have to be in the insuring agreement?
I just don't think I can answer that, Your Honor. I think that's a very broad question that...
Let me ask it the other way. If a provision is not in the insuring or a requirement, an obligation is not in the insuring agreement, does that mean it's not essential?
No, it doesn't mean it's not essential. It just means that a breach of it has to be material to excuse performance. Again, you've got to remember, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. I'm trying to understand your position. Jim. If it's in the insuring agreement, the breach of it does not have to be material. Is that what you're saying?
There is a better argument than in that situation. The breach of it does not have to be material. Or you could phrase it that a breach of the insuring agreement or something that falls without the insuring agreement simply isn't covered by the policy, so you never get to the issue of whether it's material or not because it's not insured.
And if we say putting something in the insuring agreement makes it more important, then they're going to put everything in the insuring agreement, aren't they?
That certainly... Which
will just beg the question.
Well, no, it'll just bring the court back to the same problem 10 years from now or 20 years from now with the rewritten policy trying to make everything not require prejudice again. But again, you got to remember, all of these provisions that we're talking about remain in the policy and remain enforceable if there is a breach that causes prejudice. I mean, if, for instance, the failure to report a claim as soon as practicable harms the insurance company in any way, that's still a fully enforceable requirement and provision of the policy. They've just got to show, as they do with any other contract provision, that the breach is material.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May it please the court, Ms. Rickheimer will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I think it's noteworthy that FIC in its briefs relies principally on dissents in PAJ and Hernandez to argue that QTIA has been overruled and there is now supposedly a universal notice prejudice rule in Texas. Our client, on the other hand, Your Honors, looks at what the majority speaking for this court has said, as well as what Texas appellate courts and federal courts have done for years in reliance upon the interpretive rules announced in QTIA. Unlike with occurrence policies before PAJ, there is no certainty in the law in Texas when it comes to notice requirements and claims made policies. Notice is considered in those policies to be a material part of the bargain for exchange, and as is the case in our policy, it's expressly a condition precedent to coverage. In those circumstances, courts have strictly construed the notice requirement and have not imposed something that an extra textual prejudice requirement. What this court said in QTIA is if you have a condition precedent in the insurance policy and you're uncomfortable with enforcing it, it's the responsibility of the legislature or the regulators to change that, to announce a rule in Texas. And I would even point out that with regard to an unregulated insurer, the Texas legislature can say that for unregulated parts of the industry, that this insurance company can't participate in the Texas market unless it specifies, provides a particular, complies with a particular public policy concern that's announced by the legislature.
What is the difference, if you can tell us, between claims made policies on the one hand and claims made and reported policies on the other?
To answer your question, I want to start with what I believe is the same between the two. What's the same between the two, and it came up in the first argument, so I'm not going to belabor it, is that the idea is for the insurance company to be able to close the books at the end of the period. And I think what some of the courts even have gone a little farther and said, the reason notice is so important is the insurance company opens the file for the claim, and then when the policy period is over, they close the books on that policy. That's the same in both claims made and reported. What's different is really the specific notice requirement.
Let me ask you a question about that. So you said the insurer closes the books at the end of the period. So the books are going to remain open when a claim occurs. If it's reported 8 months before the end of the period, a day before the end of the period, or 4 months before the end of the period. Why does that not suggest that as soon as practicable is not that important? Because the books are going to remain open till the end of the period regardless.
I'm going to try and answer both questions at the same time so I don't lose my train of thought. The difference between claims made, claims made, and reported is exactly what you pointed to. It's in our policy anyway, the notice provision is as soon as practicable as opposed to being during the policy period. So what happens in a policy like such as ours, where the condition precedent is notice as soon as practicable as opposed to notice during the policy period, is that you could have a situation where a claim comes in at the end of the policy period and there is some amount of opening that is for additional claims to be reported as long as they were made during the policy period. Let me just rephrase that to make sure it's clear. The reason that as soon as practicable is the choice that was made in the context of this particular policy, which does leave open some flexibility at the end of the policy period for reporting, in which case the you're going to evaluate the late report as to whether, or the report to determine whether it's late, is whether it was reported as soon as practicable. And as was pointed out in the first argument, that's somewhat of a loosey-goosey term and is based upon case law interpretation. And so there is some amount of more flexibility than in a policy that would have a specific reporting requirement or a hard stop, as was discussed earlier.
But assuming that these underwriting concerns and being able to better quantify risk are important in the claims made context. If they're not implicated in a particular claim, why shouldn't the same prejudice requirement apply?
The answer, I believe, was alluded to in your PAJ decision, because what you end up with, once you agree that notice is a material part of the bargain for exchange in our policy, for example, as in what I would submit all claims made policies, then prejudice is immaterial at that point. It's the notice provisions, a condition precedent. Prejudice is truly irrelevant. You enforce the policy provision strictly as written, as opposed in all cases. And so what I'm saying is, in the PAJ case, you mentioned a certain ludicrousness to interpreting the same policy provision differently depending on the type of claim. And I would submit it would be equally ludicrous to interpret the same exact words, the same exact policy language, if the claim is made during the policy period or after the policy period. I think that once you agree that the policy provision should be enforced strictly as written, you do it no matter when the claim occurs, whether it's within or not within the policy period.
Would you say the same thing applies to a green ink?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I wanted to, again, I want to bring it back to the general rules of contract interpretation. This court has the ability, and as any court, has the ability to look at the policy language and say, is this a condition precedent? And even if it purports to be a condition precedent, if it results in an absurd, if the results are absurd, you say that's not really a condition precedent. I'd also point out,
well, it's not if the results are absurd. It's if it works in forfeiture.
I think that it's really the cases that I've looked at in this context have also said that it's the absurdity of the result. I don't think you automatically say it's a forfeiture, so we don't enforce it. I mean, you can have a forfeiture if the condition precedent is not complied with, if the condition precedent is clear. And in our policy, I would submit, the condition precedent language is very clear for two reasons. One, it says it. Two, the nature of the coverage is such that notice has to be a condition precedent, because without a strict notice requirement, you essentially convert a claims-made policy into an occurrence policy. I think the other point that I would make on the green ink is specific to our policy.
Can you explain that statement that you just made with about converting
sure.
a claims made policy to an occurrence policy?
It's a function. Once you impose a prejudice requirement on a claims made policy, that means you're in the same boat with the occurrence policies, and essentially, at least in Texas, what the courts have said is, unless you have a default judgment that can't be overturned, you don't have prejudice. Even if you get into other areas, and that's generally where the battleground has been for prejudice, is what's happened in this claim. Even if we decide for claims-made policies we're going to introduce a new battleground, this notion of an underwriting prejudice, what you end up happening is every case becomes a trial about prejudice, because prejudice is inherent, generally speaking, at least in Texas, has been deemed to be a very inherently fact-specific argument. Again, going back to the essential part of the bargain for exchange is that we don't need to argue about prejudice. We don't need to have trials in every case about prejudice. Or in our situation, this is the third time our client has paid our law firm to come up and argue this point. I mean, it's been a very expensive proposition to argue about whether there should be
but
prejudice.
It's a straightforward matter whether a claim was made during the policy period.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So you agreed to cover claims during this policy period? A claim was made during the policy period. And the same thing applies in the occurrence policy. This looks kind of like you didn't do something fast enough. You lose all your rights.
Your Honor,
the deal was you agreed to cover a claim, and nobody doubts the claim was made during that period.
I'm going to point out two provisions of the policy that may be important to this question and to some prior questions. One, the insuring agreement says specifically subject to all terms, conditions, and limitations. So I don't think it's fair to say this policy covers claims made during the policy period no matter what without reference to what are the terms, conditions, limitations of the policy. This policy says as a condition precedent to coverage, you must provide notice as soon as practicable. That's in the policy. It's also consistent with the notion of the bargain for exchange in a claims made policy. The other thing I would point out in our policy is, and this goes to the greening question, it has a provision, for example, that says you have to provide notice to the address listed in the declarations, and it has to say attention claims department. That's a separate part of the notice provision. We're not saying that's a condition precedent at all. We're only saying there's conditions. The conditions precedent in this policy are few. In fact, I've been able to find three provisions in this policy that are conditions precedent. One is notice. One has to do with purchasing an extended reporting period, and it says, as you might expect, you, the insured, have to pay us before we're going to give you an extended reporting period. And then there's the no action provision that was discussed in the first argument. So we're not saying that everything in this policy has to be a condition precedent. We're just saying that notice is a condition precedent in this policy under existing rules of contract interpretation, going back to Qutaya, that the condition precedent gets enforced as written without reference to prejudice because it's deemed inherently material to the bargain for exchange.
Counsel, you said a moment ago, and let me take you back, that if we don't strictly enforce the notice provision, we effectively turn the a claims made policy into an occurrence policy. I was thinking that an occurrence policy, a claims made policy, if you had a claim made between the first day of the period and the last day of the period, that's what you covered. But an occurrence policy, if the occurrence happened but you didn't find out about it till 3 years later, the carrier had coverage for that. So am I missing something here?
No.
In your statement, I'm not quite making a mesh.
It becomes like an occurrence policy because of the potential delay in the because of the potential delay in the insurer's knowledge of the risk. That's
you still are limiting your they cover two different. One is claims made, they're covered. And one is an occurrence, regardless of when it's reported or regardless of when the insured finds out about it or anything else. Aren't they still different, even though we're requiring if we were to require prejudice on the notice to the carrier? we're not making claims made in occurrence policies the same.
You're making them the same in terms of the delay between the event that gives rise to coverage and the reporting, the notice to the insurer that it has a risk. So in an occurrence policy, you're absolutely right. You have an occurrence occurring during the policy period. A claim may not be made or may not be reported for some period of time afterwards. I mean, some of these, as I'm sure your honors know, in some of these long-tail claims, it can be years and years and years. And so the insurer, it's a higher premium paid for that type of coverage because a broken ankle in 1976 was worth one thing. It's worth something different today and in 2008. So that's the economic analysis of an occurrence policy is because of the uncertainty of the risk, the premiums are higher. There's an immediacy or a currency between, there has to be for a claims-made policy, between the event that gives rise to coverage, which in the case of a claims-made policy is the claim, and reporting. They have to occur close in time. That's part of the premium calculation.
Does the Department of Insurance regulate these D&O policies?
They don't, not the specific language, not in the way that it's done with CGL as in the PAJ case. Companies are certainly regulated. You have admitted insurers and non-admitted insurers issuing coverage. Just the prior case would be an example of that. But it is certainly within the jurisdiction of the regulators and the legislature to make changes, mandatory endorsements that would be required to be added for D&O or claims.
The legislature could say that to establish non-coverage because of a failure to report timely, the insurer must show prejudice. They could do that.
They absolutely could do that. They could say, and I think that was at least my reading of PAJ was critical, was that the legislature had spoken, and not just and as a result of what the legislature did, or rather, I'm sorry, the Department of Insurance did after QTIA, it resulted in the board orders, but there were also significant changes in the policy form that made that, as a matter of contract interpretation, it made sense to have a notice prejudice rule that applied to occurrence policies. And there's been nothing similar like that to occur in the context of claims-made policies, specifically directors and officers policies that are at issue here. And so, again, going back to first principles, it's not just that you have a claims-made policy that in which notice is a material part of the bargain for exchange. We've tied it up for a bow with you in our policy and said that it is in the policy, it is a condition precedent. So we've had a lot of discussion today about does this have to appear in the insuring agreement? And to me, that would make insurance policies very different from other types of contracts because I'm not aware of other contracts where there's a special part of the contract that you interpret strictly, and then the rest of it is automatically deemed to be covenants. I think general rules of contract interpretation dictate you look at the policy as a whole. This policy says, subject to all terms, conditions, limitations, we are going to provide coverage for claims that are made during the policy period. I don't think that you can ignore what is an express condition precedent to coverage just because it does not appear in the insuring agreement.
Just to be sure, you don't think it makes any difference whether the notice was given within or outside the policy period?
It should not. Once you agree, which I hope you will, that notice is a material part of the bargain for exchange, and it's an express condition precedent to coverage. It gets enforced strictly as written, and you look at what courts have deemed to be as soon as practicable. And it doesn't matter whether it's within or without the policy period. As in our case, you could have late notice within the policy period, but you could also have a case for our type of policy where notice is given a short period of time after the policy expires. If that's deemed to be as soon as practicable, there would be coverage for that claim under our policy in any event. So no, it does not matter whether it's late notice within or without the policy period. I think that just to provide another example as to why it's important to enforce these strictly as written. You've got the CompUSA case from the Fifth Circuit, which was a situation where at least it appeared, just based on the Fifth Circuit's discussion, that the policyholder there had made a conscious decision not to report the claim so as not to potentially interfere with a merger and acquisition that was being contemplated. So there are reasons to, even within the policy period, even putting aside what the underwriting reasons might be, there are other reasons why the insurer might want to have notice of the claim or as soon as practicable during the policy period.
If the insured does not give notice as soon as practicable, but the insurer begins the defense of the claim, can it still, under a reservation of rights or just a withdrawal, saying that there was no timely notice, so we're out?
Yeah, I think so, Your Honor. I mean, at least our position in general is that an insurer makes a choice as to whether it denies coverage or reserves rights based on the facts of a particular claim. And so if the insurer has adequately reserved rights on that basis, consistent with Texas law, then I believe that would be that would be appropriate way to handle the claim. But that would be the insurer's choice as to whether the facts of that particular claim.
So if they got notice from another source but not from the insurer, they could deny coverage?
I may have misunderstood your question.
That's another aspect of it.
Yeah, a notice from another Your Honor, I believe that to comply with the notice provision in this policy, notice must come from the policyholder to the insurer. And I believe, although I didn't study it for purposes of this argument, there are cases to that effect in Texas and elsewhere. So while I would not agree that notice in green ink or notice that says attention claims department is a condition precedent, I would argue that notice from the policyholder to the insurer is part of the condition precedent. I think the way some of the courts have looked at it is that there's really two pieces to notice. It's not just it's the policyholder's coverage. It's the policyholder's choice what they do with that coverage. And they may have reasons not to provide notice. They don't want the premiums to go up. They don't want to get non-renewed. They want to continue the relationship with this insurer. There are multiple reasons a policyholder may decide not to provide notice of a claim. That's why, Your Honor, some courts have said, no, notice must come from the policyholder. It's the policyholder's choice whether or not to invoke the coverage. It can't come from the claimant. I think there's other issues dealing with the rights of a claimant under an insurance policy and at what point they attach, and that also figures into the analysis as to whether notice from the claimant is sufficient under the policy. I see my time is up. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, in your mind, is there a difference between some financial difference, premium-wise or otherwise, between an occurrence policy and a claims-made policy?
I don't think so, Your Honor. There's certainly no evidence in our record that.
Then why do we have the two different kinds of policies even in existence, I wonder?
Well,
no difference.
They're different because, I'm trying to think the best way to say this.
What we've heard here today is the insurer has a finite exposure time. They know after a certain period of time on a claim is made, that risk is behind them, they can go on down the road. Whereas an occurrence policy, 5 years down the road, they may get a claim that happened 5 years ago, so they really don't know when to close their books on it. Do you disagree with that characterization?
But by the same token, if you write an occurrence policy for this year, you know you're only going to cover what's happened this year.
But you don't know what's happened until somebody tells you, and that may happen. You may get that knowledge several years down the road.
But by the same token, when you write a claims-made policy for this year, your insured may get a claim for something that happened many years ago that you didn't know about.
But at the end of the year.
It's just two different ways to set the trigger in the insuring agreement.
Okay, and so the insurance company must have some reason for writing those different kinds of policies, it would seem.
Correct.
Now, let me ask you a question on prejudice. Let's say you have a policy, a claims-made policy, with this reporting period as soon as practicable. A claim is made against your insured 6 months in there. They hire the best law firm in Texas and therefore the best law firm in the country to some people to defend them. And they defend that claim and then pay their bills themselves for the next 2 or 3 years, and then they find this policy, and then a claims made policy. And so they notify the insurance company. The insurance company takes a reservation right, hires a lawyer, looks at what's happened. They said, we couldn't have done any better. Great job. No prejudice. In that case, you would say under the claims made policy, as soon as practicable notice, even though the notice came 4 years down the road, unless the insurance company could say there's something that happened in here that we feel prejudice, in that case, they're still on the hook on the claims made policy because no prejudice. And in fact, they're better off because the insured paid their own bills for a long time. Would that be a fair characterization where we end up under your scenario?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. That again is another issue that is not really before us today, which is what happens if the report is made outside of the policy period. My inclination would be to say if truly the insurance company has not been harmed in any way by that, then, yeah, the answer may be right. I'm guessing as a practical matter that's never going to happen because their reinsurance is going to go away. Various things are going to happen so that they will be affected by it. It does, however, bring me back to one point that I wanted to make about this, that you need to be sure you understand in the context of one of these D&O policies, and that is a claim, as it is defined under this policy that has to be reported, is not a lawsuit. It's any written demand of any kind. So if the company gets a letter that says, we think you've done us wrong and you ought to make us whole for that, that's a claim, even if it doesn't progress to being a serious claim or something bigger until later. And this policy does not give the insurance company either a defense obligation or a right to control the defense. So once they're put on notice of the claim, that doesn't mean they step in and run it. What happens is exactly what you just described. The insured hires counsel to defend the claim. They pay for it. And then somewhere down the line, they ask the insurance company to reimburse them for it. And I think that, again, gets back to one of the things that was said in the prior argument. If you look at the policy in this case, if you look at Section J, Action Against the Insurer, which appears in the Fifth Circuit record at page 354, you will find that the policy provides, Section J1, no action may be taken against the insurer. That is, no one can attempt to make the insurer pay a claim under this policy unless, comma, as a condition precedent thereto, colon, A, there has been full compliance with all the terms and conditions of this policy, semicolon, and then it goes on. So the way this policy is set up, contrary to the representation that was made by opposing counsel, is that everything in this policy is a condition precedent to being able to collect any claim under it.
Are there any further questions? So your time has expired. And therefore, the cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess. Thank you, Counselor.